welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got Paul Venable. Let's not keep him in the corner there for too long. Paul, welcome back.
And as a matter, are you hearing me okay?
Yeah, I can. And let me ask you this. The 14th Amendment, I know you would have loved to have covered that, but that's actually just been placed up on the website. So I'm actually kind of ahead of schedule. Usually it takes me 2 weeks to get stuff up, but I would love to hear your comments regarding the 14th Amendment, because I know you haven't heard them yet. But anyway, with that, we left off on the 13th, the final 13th Amendment, the actual one that people recognize technically should be the 14th Amendment, and every other amendment from this point forward should be, you know, a number added to it just due to the fact that the original 13th Amendment was ratified in 1812.
Right.
And so in covering the 13th Amendment, we, you know, there's not much. I mean, it's a short and quick and to the point type of an amendment that, you know, basically just states that involuntary servitude is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Now, in my humble opinion, that doesn't actually play out anymore, because there are organizations like the federal government that does not allow people to freely come and go at will.
Sure.
And I'm going, well, how can they do that with this little snag here? But it just kind of speaks to how, I'll just say, illiterate people are, or how much they're banking on the illiteracy of people.
Because, so, G.R., I think I may have mentioned this to you as beforehand, but it's, you said involuntary servitude is unconstitutional, but there's a wrinkle in Article 13, and it says, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah, in the service of a crime, right, in doing your crime, absolutely, yeah. The penal system, that government body, can use involuntary servitude, absolutely. Sure. And so it kills me that we have all of these prisons where, you know, they're not doing productive work.
You know, that's an interesting, I have thought a lot about prison reform. And I don't believe that prisoners should be sitting idly by, you know, on their cell phones and watching TV. I believe that if they're going to eat, they need to work.
Right.
We were in a small town in near Central Ohio, and I believe that prison actually had a farm, that they were growing animals, and that the prisoners worked at that farm and processed those animals. And so it's I'm sure it's for another discussion, but one of the things that happens when prisons is people go in and they come back and they haven't learned anything. If they go in and they have to work to live, they come out, they will want to work to live, because a lot of them go in there not even knowing what that means.
I honestly think that there needs to be and it's not an education system, but at least a skills system where, you know, depending on the degree, I mean, there are people in like we'll call it white collar prison where these people have an education, and there's no reason why they can't be, you know, providing some productivity for society. To pay off their crime. And it's the same thing. Every single one of these people, the challenge really should be, how is it that you're going to work off this crime? Just sitting here rotting in a cell is unacceptable.
Right.
It's inhumane as well.
Sure. It's not good for the person, and it's not good for society.
And taking away entertainment and those other benefits, need to be, you know, a part of that too. You know, the one thing that you're guaranteed to have as a break from the monotony is the opportunity to be productive and to learn a skill or what have you. So, and there's all types of assemblies. As a matter of fact, there's certain work that's just hard to do today. As a matter of fact, why is it that America has its printing services done in China? I mean, almost all books today are being printed in China, I believe.
Oh, there's a lot of stuff being done in China.
Yeah, and so we could look at, okay, why can't we, you know, what are the things that have completely or almost completely moved offshore and say, we're going to basically bring all of that stuff back. Now, understand that there are companies that might still exist, like there are still some American publishing companies, but... You know, and bringing the printing part back, you know, may actually lay off some people. But I believe that those people that get laid off can be freed up to do something more, something different. You know, they could become management material and leadership in these facilities where, you know, we now have the labor.
Sure.
Right. And, you know, but if we go down that path, and I didn't mean to actually linger this long on this, but if we go down that path, there has to be a road to a viable alternative, or I should say, if you're doing printing and that type of production, that has to translate to something on the civilian side.
Correct.
Right. And so we kind of have to look at, you know, these are the conversations that should be happening in the county.
Yeah.
Because if we can start solving the problem at the county level, then we, you know, maybe that resolves the need for state and federal types of prisons, other than for those really bad, hardened criminals, what have you. But right. Anywho, I'm not here for social services. I'm here to educate and to help people understand what we're doing. So technically, we're really on the 15th Amendment, because having just covered with Angeline Marie the 14th Amendment, here we go. And so go ahead and start us. By the way, the 14th Amendment has just been ratified, And now this new amendment comes right along the heels of it. So do you think the South, so again, this, we keep on hearing that the South was, they weren't that bad. They were, you know, they were doing good things. You know, they were being, you know, I believe that they were obfuscating, and I think that they were trying to, you know, completely, you know, whitewash what they were trying to do, and so, or cover up what they were really trying to do. And they were really trying to oppress, because this amendment would not have come out had the South actually said, okay, you know, suck it up, folks. You know, things have changed, and now we have, you know, an open society where all people are free and, you know, are entitled to, you know, a civil, you know, opportunities, a civil world, and so forth. And instantly, they had to come out with this amendment. And then, you know, obviously, you know, when we look at history, after this amendment, then they went to other methods of harassing and oppressing.
Wow.
Right? I mean, if anybody ever heard of the Jim Crow laws?
Sure.
When you look at, I mean, you really had to be living in a cave or in a bubble to not know that what was happening in the South was absolutely tragic. And actually, it, as Thomas Sowell points out, it wasn't necessarily, you know, limited to the South. Okay. Because over time, it wasn't necessarily racial either. As government and organizations started getting away with oppressing, you know, blacks in the South, Thomas Sowell points out that as you move to the North in Illinois, people that didn't have money started to get oppressed. Mm-hmm. And he points out that that was happening to the white people.
Right.
And so anyway, go ahead.
So you're ready for Amendment 15?
I am. I'm sorry.
Okay. Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Okay.
Section 2. Go Congress ahead. Shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
You know, go ahead.
You know, this section 2, we see this in a couple places, starting with the 14th Amendment, and I don't know that that was necessary. I don't know why they started doing that, because, of course, Congress has power to enforce the Constitution with appropriate legislation. Why did they start? We'll get to 15. I just had this question. Why did they start doing that?
Okay, so they actually started doing it with the 13th Amendment.
Okay.
And then they started adding it to the 14th, the 15th, then they did it to the 18th, the 19th, and then the 23rd, the 24th, the 26th Amendment. And so, you know, so those were the places you'll find it. Why did they start doing it? I think that they kind of realized that and this was a real sleight of hand. In the 13th Amendment, when you look at that, the paradigm shift of how to get laws enforced had changed because of Lincoln. So when Lincoln wanted to prosecute his vengeance upon the South for making him look bad, he went to the militia and called them forth, and they go, "Are you kidding?" And I mean, the lackluster drive of the militia was, and actually it was the epitome, but it was a standard, because even his regular army that he unconstitutionally created, instead of using and federalizing the militia, didn't want to necessarily prosecute that war. It was just a job opportunity for these guys, and most of them didn't care whether they won the fight or not, and which is one of the reasons why, you know, they cut tails, and they didn't win anything for the first 2 years.
Wow. Interesting.
I mean, so I'm just giving you, you know, because there's lots of people that can get into the details of each battle and this and give you the analysis. I'm actually giving you the macro view. Mm-hmm. And so Lincoln violated the Constitution, and the 13th Amendment really became, I'll just say, the indictment of the shift of paradigm because of Lincoln. So in other words, Lincoln realized that the militia failed. He absolutely recognized that the militia failed to do what they're supposed to do. Now, you can't
get... really fail, or did they push back against an unconstitutional behavior?
Well, so, okay, it's the same thing, because his regular army did the same thing.
Okay.
Right? But what he did, instead of trying to fix the problem with the militia, he just basically said, I'm going to, you know, create, you know, this army, because getting the state legislature, because creating a federal army outside of the militia, the one thing it saved him was it saved him bypassing the state legislatures.
Okay.
See my point? So now he didn't have to beg people to, you know, give me people to fight a war that is, you know, unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
However, had he changed and he basically made it about slavery at the very beginning, I think that, you know, we'd be talking completely different. Had, you know, he actually, had he probably prostrated and kept himself prostrated with the Lord and, you know, was really trying to solve the problem and heal the nation, I think it would have been a different story. But he didn't. And I think that these people that always, you know, glamorize Lincoln, you know, I look at his memorial and all I see is a tyrant, you know, in his little throne. Because that's what it looks like. He looks like he is the god sitting on a throne, a demigod. That's my opinion.
Well, he's looked at that way.
What's that?
He's looked at that way.
Well, I think that that was a deliberate depiction of him. And I think that that was a message because, and it's a bad message because here was probably our worst president, one of our worst presidents of all time. He should have actually gone about this in complete. Now, it's really easy to do armchair quarterbacking, but anyway, I don't want to just make this all about Lincoln. I know I am very critical of the man, but I know that he was walking in different shoes and his education, and I don't think he would have changed anything based on what he knew. But I think that, you know, at this point in time, there's no doubt in my mind, he would probably say, oh, yeah, I would have done this differently. I would have done this differently. I would have done this differently because of the problem that he basically bestowed upon America.
Mm. Now, but he inherited another problem. Okay.
Okay.
Right? And he inherited a nation that was supposed to have gotten rid of slavery, right? And one of the ways I look at it is however tyrannical he may have been, forgive me for those who might be offended by this, the instrument in God's hands.
Yeah, but see, that wasn't his intent.
No, that wasn't his intent.
Right.
I'm not saying it was his intent.
So he may have inherited it, but that wasn't even in play with him.
Right.
He ignored it.
Yeah, but the Lord couldn't ignore this. We were supposed to get rid of slavery. And I wonder, what I'm saying is, I wonder if this wasn't the cost the nation paid for not having cleaned that up when it was intended and in the Constitution.
Yeah. So I know what you're saying, and I agree with you because I do believe that God's will be done. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt in my mind that America needed a tyrant, and America needed to. As a matter of fact, George Mason predicted that this nation and these states would be punished. If we didn't solve these problems, and I think George Mason could have actually been given the opportunity. I don't know if he was really being prophetic because the Lord really said, okay, I know it's going to happen, and you're absolutely right on this, because we know that the Missouri Compromise was integral in continuing slavery, and we would have never have had to go to Lincoln. Things would have changed dramatically had people lived and abided by the Constitution and allowed things to take its natural course. But right, that's not the case. So I'm not sure if Mason was as prophetic that he knew that, you know, but because I honestly don't think he saw the end of slavery in the Constitution like those in Pennsylvania did, like those in Massachusetts did.
Okay.
I don't think that he wasn't necessarily a righteous man. I just don't think he saw it because he was so focused on the Bill of Rights and what he thought was really important.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were plenty, but to be truthful, when we look at how things were going, the Constitution proved him wrong in my perspective.
Hmm. Okay.
Because he made a lot of assertions in the ratification debates that, you know, this would happen. But the assumption is that, you know, the Constitution was the problem based on what he was saying. But actually, the reality was what he was saying was going to happen, like the dissolving of the militia, that all was going to happen because the Constitution was going to be violated.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, he contributed, you know, significantly in demanding a Bill of Rights so that everybody learned about the rights that were restricted instead of the only powers that were enumerated.
Right. In other, yes, right. George Washington is considered the father of the Bill of Rights, right?
Yes. And he actually, he was the author or the keystone to the Virginia Bill of Rights, which actually preceded the Constitutional Bill of Rights. I think that they did that in like 1785, you know, a couple of years before the Constitutional Convention. And Madison was on that committee with them as a green legislator in the state of Virginia. But my point is, we've really digressed, but my real point is this, is that I think George Mason, you know, he fell backwards into being right about this because he was just too stubborn and obstinate in demanding his Bill of Rights. Now, okay. I've told you that it's kind of like the chicken and the egg or these other paradoxes, had we not had the Bill of Rights and, you know, everything else went, had we had faith and had we moved forward and not created the Bill of Rights, we probably wouldn't have suffered we wouldn't have suffered Civil War and the necessity of the 14th Amendment.
Really?
Right. If you really think about it, because just think about it. Had everybody started learning that these are the few powers that are granted, that they can't do anything that is not enumerated. In other words, they can't make a law respecting religion. They can't basically do anything other than use the militia as they're supposed to, that every man be armed and that the militia system be supported. Had we complied to this Constitution, we would never have needed a Bill of Rights, and I believe we wouldn't have fought that Civil War. I believe that those men in Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and the other states recognized that the Constitution was going to eradicate in a natural process slavery and move this nation forward.
Mm.
And so I say that the reason why we had a Bill of Rights is because these men must have been at least moved by the Lord to know that there were going to be players already moving and creating these little, I'll just call them conspiracies, or these little organizations like Hamilton with the lawyers and judges and this little, you know, game he was playing in aggrandizing government power, that the Lord knew that men were going to, and they were actively working to undermine the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of goes to, you know, that very, very famous Federalist paper where, you know, Madison talks about, you know, men and angels, where he says, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external or internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. And so, you know, when we really look, I mean, yeah, this was put into the hands of men, and throughout the annals of history, men always do bad things. We're going into break, so hold on, Paul. We'll be right back so that we can finish up the 15th Amendment and actually get into the progressive amendments, because now we're going to go a half century and jump into progressive amendments. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
Hey,
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so with that, Paul, we really kind of wandered along from the
from the
15th Amendment into the Civil War and so forth. But does it make sense what I'm saying? I only God knew what was going to happen. Only God.
For sure.
And so I don't think Mason was the prophet or anything else, but I think that, you know, he was right. There were lots of people that stumbled into the being right. But it doesn't mean that Madison and the Federalists in the ratification debates were wrong. They created a system that if it was followed and complied with, we would not have had all of these problems. And that, I think, is the crux of the matter. You know, when most people think that the Constitution isn't perfect, and they say that most people just think that it's, you know, it's got a lot of flaws or it's flawed. And I'm saying, no, I think that what the flaw is the hands that it's been put in. Because I think that the Constitution was far better of an instrument than these men even understood.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you.
Because when we really look at, okay, so the 11th Amendment just proved that the court couldn't be trusted. They started overreaching. The 12th Amendment was really a failing in the design of the Electoral College that, you know, when there was a real contention, it took a long time. And so when we, you know, when I look at, you know, the amendments that we have here, a lot of them, like when we look at the 25th and we look at some of these other amendments, I'm going, you know what? I honestly don't see how, you know, the Constitution was necessarily failed. I think that it's just that because we have had problems in administering because we have, you know, created all these contentions and so forth. Right? I mean, you know, it's just like, Prohibition, really? Seriously? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that as a nation and as an enlightened nation, we should have actually been working, because we've talked about this before. Alcohol was an integral part of society.
Right.
And so to go from a society that had a dependency to completely eradicating the consumption of alcohol, which is what the Prohibition Amendment was kind of leaning towards, well, that would have, had they used the methodology of enlightenment, of actually teaching children to actually, you know, abstain from, you know, partaking of alcoholic drinks, we've now have, you know, refrigeration. We have technology, the necessity of that. It's an ancient thing.
You know, it's an ancient thing. I understand that alcohol wasn't just something that was consumed. A lot of people don't know that, you know, farmers produced alcohol as part of their sometimes their feed process.
Yeah.
And back when back when the Model T was around, you could run it. You know, you could run a Model T on gasoline. You could also run it on alcohol.
Yep.
And sometimes people would go to the farmer and fill up their Model T. Well, you can't do that now. Nope. Because
you're right. We have a lot of technology involved, and some of that technology involved actually helps protect the auto manufacturers so that you can't work on your own car.
The oil companies, right?
Right. Yeah. So I just look at a lot of the changes that we've made has been more of, you know, maybe our failings of administering, or maybe our failings as a society to maintain enlightenment. Had we kept on moving forward with enlightenment and actually trying to improve life for all, the problem is that we become divisive because we try to start serving agendas. And, you know, this is how people get rich. This is how people get killed.
Right.
There's a lot of money and there's a lot of business in being divisive and destructive.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, let's go to the 16th.
So we went to Article 15 and I went straight to Section 2. We didn't even discuss, I think you led into Section 1, but we really didn't discuss it much. What happened in Article 15 is that black people or those who had been in a condition of servitude, they're were given the right to vote. They had been made United States citizens, right? Or recognized as United States citizens. And now, and this had to be done because, as you mentioned, states were restricting their right to vote.
Right. And another method that they were restricting that we'll have another amendment down the road, which I think was a tragedy, was the poll tax.
Hmm. Okay.
I believe that we should have, what they should have done in that following amendment is that every person should have a right to elect their representative, but all other matters should be left to those who have skin in the game. In other words, if it is about levies, if it's about taxation on property or what have you, then you shouldn't just be able to vote in a democracy, like a democracy form of government, to say, you know, I don't have any property, but I'm okay with taxing you so that, you know, we can have money to help me.
Got it.
That is wrong. That was immoral. And I believe that that amendment was a part of the progressive agenda. I believe that, you know, we should have allowed poll taxes or just kept people from being able to vote in something they had no business voting in.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. It's if you have, like you say, skin in the game, if you're a landowner, then and you're allowing someone else to express their voice about the condition of your property, that actually sounds like a usurpation.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with, I would say, the school education stuff. I think you have to have skin in the game if you're going to be engaged in the curriculum for children.
Like, have kids of your own or what?
Well, no. So what's the whole point of education? Is to prepare a child to become a productive member of society. So what are the requirements of becoming a productive member of society? Well, first off, you have this duty to serve in the militia. So that education should actually be preparing a child to be able to do that. And understand the responsibilities and openly welcome, you know, growing into these roles that make our society better than anywhere else that you can live in the world. The other, I'll say, people who have skin in the game are employers. Employers should actually be, you know, driving, oh, we need, you know, this level of math. We need this level of comprehension. You know, we need, we don't need social engineering. And so there's a lot of players that I think aren't included at the table because, you know, the parents are there, but there's way too many parents that open their arms to social engineering. And they actually stifle, you know, what the whole point of preparing these children to become productive members of society. And so, I think it's time we actually had, you know, some honest conversations, because it's not that, you know, I'm right, you know, in what I'm saying, because I'm only talking in fragments here, but I honestly believe that we're really failing ourselves because we're not having these conversations as a county, and actually just because it's about me or it's about those people and what they want instead of what is the whole point of education. If it is to prepare a child to be a productive member of society, then okay, it is something that society must provide. And I'm okay with that. But who is going to inherit these children for being productive? It's going to be the work, right? It's going to be their employer. It's going to be the businesses. And what are business standards today? Do we really need kids to learn that it's okay for Sally? I mean... We shouldn't be teaching children to be biased, nor should we be driving them down social norms or trying to create social norms. There's no business in education for that. There's business for being compassionate as a human being, but not to actually just say, well, that's acceptable because sin is sin. And there are consequences. When we actually start, changing what that a sin is not necessarily a sin anymore. It's just what these people choose to do. Well, no, it's still a sin. And so anyway, I digress. When we look at the 15th Amendment, I believe that this was an indictment that actually proved that the 14th Amendment wasn't done, that they didn't realize enough of the problems that were going on in the South, and still the South overwhelmed us, or I should say overwhelmingly proved that these guys didn't know how bad they were with the Jim Crow laws and so forth, because technically the Jim Crow laws were covered by the 14th Amendment. When we talk about equal protection under the law, you know, had they applied that equal protection, Jim Crow laws would never have gained traction and become legitimized. Never.
Had they applied what?
Equal protection.
Okay.
So in other words, separate but equal, and those types of principles and reinterpretations of the 14th Amendment would never have oozed out of the court system or seeped out. Anyway, okay, so the 16th Amendment, now it's something that was done in 1909, questionably ratified, and I tell people, I agree that we need to audit and determine whether this was actually legitimately ratified or not, but I don't have, and I've never taken the time to do the details on this, but here we have the 16th Amendment, go ahead.
Okay, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration.
Okay, so this amendment was written by people that did not understand the Constitution and actually created a paradox. In other words, the Constitution allows government to directly tax, but they cannot tax unevenly. In other words, the uniform requirement means that they have to do it evenly. They can't choose. Just because you're a winner, we can pick on you. The right. uniformity clause was completely ignored in this, and they did not address this. So, I mean, this, there's nothing in here that basically says anything other than that they now have the ability to directly tax income.
So almost like, you know, when we get to when we discussed this, when we get to the discussion of the 17th Amendment, it will be something like this. They wanted to do one thing, but they ignored another part of the Constitution.
Yep.
Okay. And the part they ignored was where taxes had to be applied uniformly throughout the United States. Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And then on top of that, I think you point out now they have these things called, you know, targeted tax cuts in which, you know, someone gets a benefit for doing a certain behavior. Where is that? Where is that in the Constitution? Or where they tax corporations? I'm sure that I never got the idea, and I got this from you, that, you know, who gave the federal government the authority to tax corporations? Well, if you have corporate personhood, then I guess they claim they can tax corporations. But really, corporations don't pay the taxes. They just pass that down to the cost of their goods, which, again, bites the people in the back in just another way, right?
So technically, the 17th Amendment, or the 16th, I mean.
Right.
The 16th Amendment was a way to open the door to regulate corporations. Because now that they could tax them, they started getting into regulating them more and more and more and more. You got to remember that the trust busters, you know, preceded this, and the attack on corporations in America by the federal government. And technically what ended up happening was, as corporations and or companies started growing and actually becoming a national corporation, like DuPont, like, you know, Standard Oil, and those large corporations that started spreading across the entire United States, well, corporations begged the federal government to protect them.
From what?
From,
they're huge.
Yeah, so to protect them from the disparaging treatments from one state to the next. In other words, they wanted to have a uniform. So there were lots of things that they started doing prior to the turn of the century that actually started giving. I mean, if you look at the railroad system, there was a corporation that was operating across several states. And right. So the federal government, just like the religious people wanted the federal government to get involved in marriage in the 1800s, they rued the day when they crossed that line and basically stepped in and said homosexuality is now, you know, game for marriage as well. In other words, you will rue the day when you ask government to come and to help you solve your problem. Mm-hmm. And corporations were the ones that said, hey, we see this huge advantage, because at this point in time, they weren't being taxed. If they weren't exporting, if they didn't have, you know, there was excises, those forms of taxes, but not income. Corporations, just like farmers, everybody went to the federal government asking for a handout, even churches and religions started asking the federal government for protection in the 1830s to say, hey, you know, we need an employment program. This is when they went to Andrew Jackson. There was a whole bunch of preachers from the South and, you know, these, I'll say, the very rural states. And they said, you know, our people need a job. And so he created these highway programs even after he vetoed, you know, that highway bill. Because people needed to work. And so they went to the federal government, said, can't you give him a job? And that was one of the things he said, well, I guess we could do that. And so that's why, you know, after that, Congress started getting away with doing more and more job bills, or I should say, you know, road bills, waterway bills, and all of these other things, so that we have the Erie Canal system, or, you know, this the Great Lakes Canal systems, that I believe federal dollars got involved in all of that. This is where all of these different people kept on walking into the federal government and saying, hey, we need you to do this. Now, had the framers created a wall around the federal government and created a system that says you can't enter, you can't talk, you can't engage the federal government unless it is through over any of these enumerated things. You walk in with baggage for railways. You walk in baggage for growing your food, you know, or trying to get price fixing for the, you know, your food and so forth, then you can't come in.
So here's what it looks like you're saying this. We had states and a growing number of states, but you had large corporations that had to figure out how to deal with a business in each state, and it may not be the same. So they wanted kind of a uniform protection, but the bite they got in the back was taxation.
Right. So actually, when you really look at, well, that was one of those things, along with regulations, taxations, right, and regulations. Mm-hmm. Okay. So everybody that was knocking on the door of the government, the federal government, mm-hmm, they all ended up opening the door to unleash tyranny on them. They asked them for tyranny, and they got it.
Okay.
Because bottom line, even though it's something you really need, do you go to the devil for a loan?
Yeah, then you get the devil.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have all of these problems. But this right here, the 17th Amendment, was this huge concept. This was this altruistic idea that Woodrow Wilson was going to spend America into prosperity.
You mean the 16th Amendment?
The 16th Amendment, yes. Yeah, okay. I meant that, yeah, because it's about taxes. I just said the 17th wrong. I'm sorry, folks.
Yeah.
So again, my dyslexia, whatever. But the 16th Amendment was it was a temporary amendment. Go look at how this was sold. This was sold, oh, we're only going to do that. Well, then why make an amendment?
Sure.
Then why not, you know, or actually, why didn't they actually put in the 16th Amendment a sunset? In other words, this amendment is only valid until this point in time, and that another clause to extend this amendment would be required by the states.
You know, I know there is a question about the ratification, but I think there's a mindset among the American people that if there was a movement to repeal the 16th Amendment, I think it would go somewhere.
So I honestly think that once we get government forced into not being, because see, show me in this amendment, now that you have it in front of you, show me where they can spend money on anything that they have no authority to spend money on. Where is that?
It's not there. Okay? It's just your Article 1, Section 8 has not been repealed. Right?
That's right.
Okay? It's not there. All it says is that they can collect taxes on income.
That's right.
Whatever source derived.
So people say that, oh, well, this is the door that's, you know, has created all of this debt. Mm-hmm. Where, show me. Where? This is only changing their mechanism of collecting taxes. Folks, all of the people that are running around like chickens with their heads cut off. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman in Washington State that you know, I won't mention, that was adamant that the 16th Amendment was our greatest problem. Mm-hmm. And I am here to tell you, no, he's wrong. Noncompliance of the Constitution is our greatest problem. I mean, mm-hmm. it is an overarching, it is not understating, it is absolutely putting the hammer right on the nail, or the head of the nail, that it is about compliance to the Constitution. It's not about the 16th Amendment. The 16th Amendment would actually just, we could leave it there, but we could actually just get rid of it if the federal government was spending money in accordance to the Constitution, period.
Well, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, but between Article 16 and Article 17, around that era, something did happen that probably should have been an amendment, and it wasn't, and that was the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Yes, right? But see, Hamilton already basically created that hole in the levee with the national banks.
Okay.
By establishing national banks, the Federal Reserve was basically establishing a national bank. The only difference was it happened to be a foreign entity.
Well, that doesn't square with the Constitution.
Well, neither does the creation of a bank. That doesn't square with the Constitution either.
Right.
Now, the Assumption Act, you know, literally played it out, and I think that's one of the reasons why Madison really, you know, was just, okay, now he realized that he had been duped when the Assumption Act led to the setting up of the banks. That's when he realized that this creature he was dealing with was far more devious than he gave him credit for. Okay, so now that we created the National Bank, you know, it was extended and extended, and they couldn't get rid of it. Even Madison was tied to it, you know, in his presidency. And even Jackson, you know, even though he kind of didn't want to restore it, he didn't kill it. In other words,
didn't renew the charter, but he didn't smash it to bits.
He basically, correct, what he should have done was he should have said, this is unconstitutional, and therefore I'm making an executive order that Congress shall never create a bank again.
Okay, so with a minute left, let me ask a question. Can a president today say that, you know, the Federal Reserve is unconstitutional and we're not going to do this?
Yes. Yes. So a president, what is the president's primary job?
To see that the laws of the union or the Constitution are enforced.
Correct. So if the federal government is doing something that they have no authority to do, does the president have the authority to undo it?
He has the requirement to undo it.
Okay, but what he needs the states to actually draw that line instead of him being the bad guy, because bottom line, the next president that comes along can say, hey, now, actually, this might, you know, because I said this on my presidential campaigns earlier in the summer, early summertime. Now, if, let's say Trump gets in office again and actually he listens and he does what we're going to do, well, then we'll have to talk about it in our next episode about what the president, if the president actually did this, one way of actually teaching a lesson to, you know, make sure that people would not think quickly to tread that water again or to do those unconstitutional things again. With that, we will have Paul back tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.